Okay, good morning, and well, thanks organizers for inviting me for this intense conference, very interesting, and for the audience to stick around for the third straight day listening to talks. So I'll talk about topology of the Fermi surface wave functions. The work is almost completely done by Iris Alexander Donata, who was a postdoc at Yale for 3 years before moving on. So a short title would be "The Hazelnut Effect in Topological Metals." Okay, so if you want to detune now, that's basically one thing that you may remember. So I'll quickly tell about the magnetic oscillations in metals, classical and quantum effects, and then focus on the periodicity and phase of magnetic oscillations. The phase actually is a quantum thing, and for that we should dwell into the semiclassical quantization of Bloch states rather than free particles. Then we'll see that there are some symmetry constraints for the phase of magnetic oscillations. We'll look at degenerate Landau bands near degenerate Landau bands and figure out what is the generalization of Wigner von Neumann no crossing statement for the Landau levels. So that's basically, and there'll be some, I hope that I'll get to some applications. Actually, one of them recently appeared, thanks to Andrei, who reminded me about it. So to start with, basically we're thinking of electrons that move in periodic lattice, so that the wave functions are Bloch waves, which are products of plane waves and strictly periodic Bloch vectors. So we can look at one Brillouin zone. And in a conductor, the Fermi level sits somewhere in the band rather than in the gap, so that there are particles propagating, electrons propagating through the entire sample. All the low energy properties, specific heat, conductivity, essentially at low temperatures are defined by quasi-particles that are living near the Fermi surface. And it may be, for example, hexagonal, which as we learned is different from a circle. In general, the Fermi surface may become quite complex, okay? And the Fermi surface basically is a solution of an equation where we equate the dispersion relation to the Fermi energy, and that defines the surface in momentum, in quasi-momentum space. For various materials, it's very different. So here's copper, lead, bismuth. Well, there is an entire industry of how to calculate it from first principles, but most importantly, there is also there are experimental techniques to measure Fermi surfaces. So far, ARPIS was mentioned as a great method. Now, in a finer resolution at smaller energy scales, what is used and what was used for many decades is actually magnetic oscillations. If we apply magnetic field to a charged particle, the situation becomes quite inconvenient because there is periodic potential and also vector potential that sits in the kinematic momentum. So in general, spectrum modifies a lot and becomes complicated. However, one can simplify problem substantially if magnetic length is long compared to the latest parameter. And that was understood back in early 30s by Rudolf Peierls, who invented Peierls substitution. So basically, the idea, the prescription is that you take the quasi-momentum, which is a number, and promote it to an operator, P minus E over CA, where P acts only on the plane wave component of the Bloch function, which means basically that you take the dispersion relation epsilon of h bar k and promote it to the level of Hamiltonian, replacing k by this operator, p minus a. Now, even if one does this on the level of physical physics, situation is quite cute, because you're getting a Hamilton function, which in general is not p-squared over 2m. It's something that knows about the dispersion relation for electron annihilators. And then if I look at classical equations of motion, then the first equation basically is self-contained. So this equation allows you to find momentum evolution in time, okay, because the gradient of epsilon is velocity, right? So, but it's also a function of momentum. So this equation can be solved in principle. It's clear that there is interval of motion, which is momentum along the direction of the field. So we call it P sub z. And then if you solve this equation, then it's easy to find orbits in real space, because basically compare these two, you see that the real space and momentum space basically are related to each other by rotation by 90 degrees and some scaling this vector b, right? So if you know the motion of a particle in momentum space, you know motion of particle in real space. So once again, without magnetic field, an electron is a point at the Fermi surface. You apply a field and electron starts to move along the Fermi surface, along some orbit. And this for a closed surface, it's a closed orbit. And this motion can be translated into the real space motion, which is a cyclotron or helicon orbit if I account for the non-zero momentum velocity along the direction of the field. Now, the periodic motion allows one to have resonances, and one may envision resonances kind of in space and in time. So here is an example of magnetic acoustic oscillations resonance, where one looks at absorption of sound resonances when the sound wavelength is commensurate to the radius of the orbit. And this is the resonance due to the synchronization in time, when the period of the or the frequency of the external microwave field is adjusted to the cyclotron period of electron motion along the orbit. And actually, it was shown by Shockley in the 50s that the period of the motion can be expressed in terms of the energy derivative of the cross-section of the Fermi surface. Now, you can, of course, make many cross-sections of the Fermi surface because Pz is conserved, right? So you can cut it in many different ways. And these different orbits will have different, say, different diameters and may have different frequencies. But it's clear that the density of orbits is maximal near the extremal cross-sections. And these are the cross-sections that actually show up in experiment. So basically, if one looks at fields at which there is a resonance, there is a way to extract the extremal cross-sections and the periods of cyclotron motion, which is basically is what is called cyclotron mass. So d epsilon has, basically it's a mass that would correspond to a free particle quantization, motion in the magnetic field. So now that's basically all about what I wanted to say about classical oscillations. Now, at a quantum level, we think of the Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization rules that is applied to metals with parallel substitution were developed by Lifshitz and Azagar around 51-52. And basically, the quantization rules that appeared there can be written the following way. It's a product of the cross-sectional area of a Fermi surface at given Pz times magnetic length squared should be equal to 2 pi n plus pi. So this pi is easy to understand. So electron makes a circle in real space. If I project its motion on a plane, then it will just go back and forth between two turning points. And these turning points, as usual in quantum mechanics, create you this phase shift for the wave function. And this two phase shifts at the ends at turning points combine into this pi. So Iris told me that it's called Maslov correction. And actually, Ong told me that this is called Anzeiger phase vector. And that was useful, but then I could use Google and find who looked at it before. So if you look at a fixed magnetic field, then semi-classically you'll get just equidistant levels, and the frequency, as I said, scales as 1 over dA d epsilon, and this is basically the definition of the cycloton mass, m star. If you would have just p squared over 2m dispersion relation, then this m star will be just the m sitting in p squared over 2m. In a metal, actually, it's tough to change the Fermi level because of neutrality condition. So instead, we may ask a question, what happens if you change magnetic field at fixed Fermi level, okay? And so fixed Fermi level means that it's even not dependent on magnetic field. I have to say in advance that in 2D, it just doesn't work because Fermi level does jump from one level, from one Landau level to another, levels are discrete. But in 3D, it works very well for most metals with reasonable density, electron density, so that the number of Landau levels is high. So if we fix chemical potential at just nominal Fermi level, then we basically have to rethink this left-hand side of the Boltzmann-Rayfeld relation, replacing En by Fermi energy. And then look at this equation as the equation for Ln's, for the inverse magnetic fields at which something happens. Okay, what happens basically, yet another Landau level emerges from below the Fermi level. Okay, so it was occupied and now it's empty. So as we see, the sequence of 1 over b's creates is equidistant. So basically, if one plots L squared, so 1 over b, versus n, and n, okay, so I don't know from which n should I count, but my point is that if I extrapolate it to formally infinite field, so if I extrapolate it down to L equals 0, it crosses this line, and the prediction that it crosses at half integer value, okay? So n may be a million, I don't know, maybe it's 100, but this point, according to this equation, must be minus 1/2. Okay, well, plus any integer you want to like to add. So now, in terms of observations, those are just your quantization condition. Observable could be, for example, the magnetization, and it does oscillate, and that's what is called the Hasse-Van-Alphen oscillations. And if one looks at high temperatures, then in the maximum oscillation, this is additional phase pi over 4 that comes simply from Poisson summation. It's there's an expansion of Bessel functions, say. So it's this is just a calculational thing. This is physics. Thanks to Pong, indeed I found that people looked at actually at Anzeiger phase shift, confirming that it's what you expect to have, at least for cadmium. Now, in principle, one may also look at the phase shift in principle by looking at Landau level. So instead of fixing Fermi level change magnetic field, instead fixing magnetic field and looking at different energies with the help of STM. So for two dimensions, it's important because, as I said, in two dimensions, actually Landau level, the Fermi level will jump from one Landau level to another. So in principle, Landau levels are seen, but nobody tried to go to such lengths to find the phase shifts. We had a visitor who gave some talk about numerical talk about quantization, well, about the open, basically about the open Fermi surfaces, and he somehow by some miracle was getting Landau levels, which was strange, and that was basically the beginning of our discussion with Iris, and Aris, being a great mind, asked, who told you that it must be pi? Okay. I told him, but he doesn't recognize authority. So basically what he started asking himself about and myself, whether this pi is a robust thing or it's just because of the Pyle's substitution. And there are two things in Pyle's substitution. One is fairly simple. So this Maslow correction comes from the two balancing points, and that assumes that you can deform trajectory to a circle. So, if, for example, figure eight would not work. But this is relatively simple. It's I mean, this Maslow index actually is derived for more complex trajectories as well. The other thing is more important, in my view. This operator R that sits here in Pyle substitution acts only on the plane wave factor. It doesn't act on self-periodic function. Okay. I cooked up for myself an example when actually that makes it to make an error. So example is Rajba to Deg. Was enough said here about it. In Rajba to dimension guess, there is this term which knows about the mutual orientation of spin and electron momentum. So if I fix energy, then it will give me two different values of momenta depending on the helicity of the state. I can look at state where the momentum and spin look this way or this way, okay? And depending on the mutual orientation, I'll get, for given energy, I'll get two different values of momenta. So they'll be kind of two Fermi surfaces in momentum space for two helicities. So that's one of them. And now, as I said, so a magnetic field, you take a point as a Fermi surface and start moving around. And in this case, spin moves together with momentum remaining perpendicular to it. So by the time I make a full circle, spin 1/2 makes a full circle too. Okay, so the wave function will acquire -1 because it's spin 1/2. And because the wave function must be uniquely defined, it means that in the Borel-Zimmershall conditions, there'll be additional pi coming from this -1. Which does change the phase, Anzeiger phase vector. So there are two ways to look at it. What I showed now, or try to wave my hands through, is that the fact that basically spin rotates in the plane and there is 2 pi solid angle built on the spin trajectory. But another way to say it is that the wave function is a spinner and components depend on the direction of the momentum. And if I take into account the Berry connection that comes from the derivative of the spinner, I'll get a term that actually should be somehow should appear in the quantization conditions. Okay, so basically that is a starting point. And what Iris did is that he just went all the way to looking at spectrum that has d degenerate bands. Each band may create L trajectories. So you may have a complicated, for example, in graphene, one band, say, we spin up at small energies creates two circles. And this would be two trajectories if I apply magnetic field perpendicular to the plane. So the degeneracy of orbits is D times L, right? So number of degenerate bands times the number of trajectories. What we did is we derived a generalized semi-classical quantization condition. So these lambdas are some eigenvalues. It used to be pi in my previous slide for Rajba. We found a rank DL matrix that defines the exponents of I lambda in terms of the Hamiltonian. And actually, we have a theory where this equation for the exponents is gauge invariant, meaning that it doesn't depend on the phases chosen for the basis functions. So finally, one can show, and it's fairly simple, that there are 10 symmetry classes for closed Fermi surface extremal orbits. And this only 10 is beyond my comprehension, but there is a group theoretical derivation that Iris went through to show that there are no more than 10. So just simple examples. The conventional two-deck no spin orbit but effective mass is different from the free particle mass. Then in our language, it's d equals 2 because there is spin degree of freedom, and we have two bands, spin up and spin down. And each band contains just one orbit, right? So just p squared over 2m, you cut it and you have just one circle. Now, in this case, in conventional language, we know about Zeeman splitting, and Zeeman splitting is different from H bar omega c because the masses are not equal, right? So the Bohr magneton knows about m naught, and Landau levels know about m star. So, and Zeeman splitting is symmetric. So in our language, in our new language, is that it means that this sum of two lambdas equals to zero, okay? So that's a simple example. Now, the Rajba to Deg, in this case, d equals one, right? Because again, this two Fermi surfaces in my language are two different bands, belong to two different bands. And in each of the bands, there is just one Fermi surface. So d equals one, l equals one. And lambda equals pi. That can be obtained just from this symmetric considerations that I will tell in a minute. But one can look at a more complicated case where basically the Berry connection is non-abelian. So for example, in principle, you can deform graphene so that you couple the cones, and that would correspond to canting of the pseudospin in d equals 2, l equals 2 case. So again, d equals 2 is just spin, but l equals 2 is non-trivial. So now, in terms of machinery, what was done is the following thing. Basically, you separate the energy, the Hilbert space on the low energy part and high energy part. So these are degenerate bands, this is the rest. And then in the leading approximation, if you take into account only p, the main term comes from piles. And then expanding in a magnetic field, next term, so linear in b, would be terms coming from three sources. One is the Berry connection. So that's all, that contains only wave functions within p. Then there is a Zeeman term. This is just conventional Zeeman energy. And finally, there is an orbital moment, or Ross by the name of the first paper on this subject, Ross term, that comes from the virtual transitions from the low energy manifold p to a high energy manifold in the presence of magnetic field. So basically, this term is coming from r cross p, where both r and p are off diagonal matrix elements of coordinate and momentum between the bands. So next, you expand the Wilson loop in H1 in this correction to the Hamiltonian. And the main term gives you sweep of the cyclotron orbit. And the correction basically generates a propagator which is unitary. And its eigenvalues are exactly the lambdas, or exponents of lambdas, that enter into the quantization condition. So basically, the physical requirement is that the wave function is unique. So when you go around from some point all the way to the same point, you must end with the same function, right? So that gives you basically the eigenvalues of e to I lambda. So once again, the Berry term contains the Berry connection. The Ross term contains the off-diagonal matrix elements of angular momentum, and Zeeman is, I didn't write it, it's just conventional Zeeman term. Now, where the symmetry comes in, so basically what one needs to do is to apply all the non-trivial elements of point group symmetry to these three terms, and applying these terms allows you to see the invariance for propagator. And again, there are only 10 classes, as I said, of symmetric orbits, and here is why. So basically, by this point symmetry, you can relate, you can, by applying an element of point group symmetry, you can map point K onto itself, or you can map point K to a point difference in itself, but still in the orbit. And then it may be on the same orbit or on a distinct orbit. So there are L orbits, right? So there is a possibility to go from one orbit to another. Now, one can do it without reflection or with reflection, and with or without the time reversal. So now, if K goes to K, so this is out. You cannot change the orientation, so reflection is out. And the only thing we can do is just time reversal. Okay, so there are two possibilities here. And in each of these possibilities, we have both possibility of changing the applying reflection and time inversion. So 2 times 2 is 4, and you can do it on the same orbit, on different orbits, so it's 4 plus 4 plus 2. So it's 10, and it has nothing to do with the famous 10 ways of topological classification. It's just crystalline symmetry. So now you shouldn't look at these details, but this column is useful. So there are constraints on lambdas one can get from this consideration, and actually these constraints are meaningful. Different materials belong to different classes here. Now this zero, I just focus on zero and pi, which is kind of the simplest case. Actually, one can distinguish between zero and pi by some additional consideration, looking at the contractibility of the orbit. So in this case, I'm just showing figures. In this case, I can contract circle changing energy to zero. In this case, if I do it, I have singularity because two orbits will contract to the same point. And basically, these two cases correspond to zero and pi. Again, I will skip details just claiming this result. Now, another thing that is actually, I think, physically rich is that you may look at a situation where you change symmetry class by changing the Fermi energy. And here's an example. So if you have a saddle point, it's kind of Lipschitz type, you can have Lipschitz type phase transition. So basically, you can go from the case when you have a single connected trajectory to a double connected trajectory. Okay, so physically, mathematically, it's different classes, but physically, I can continuously go from this to this. So how does it happen? And there is another wonderful phenomenon, which is called magnetic breakdown. So trajectory may be classical everywhere except a very narrow point, a very small region, where the waist of the trajectory is very thin, or you know, the two separate things are very close to each other. And this vicinity should be considered quantum mechanically, which was done ages ago. But what we add to it is that we know actually the phases that are sitting in these cosines, and they include the topological terms like Berry phase. So here's an example. So for the Lipschitz transition, basically the typical case situation when you annihilate two Berry phases, when you lump two circles into one. For Weyl 2 material, the Berry phase trade places. So now, in the rest of 3 minutes probably, I would like to tell about generalization on the almost degenerate orbits. So once again, I mentioned Rush Bagas, say Gelimer Sinai has very small spin orbit, and it would be nice to have machinery that would allow perturbatively looking at small splitting due to a breaking of symmetry or small spin orbit. So the idea is that basically we can account on the same footing for these additional terms by adding a term to this this perturbative Hamiltonian. So I start from a mother lattice that didn't have spin orbit and had spin degeneracy, but then you add a term that you consider perturbatively, and then you repeat all the steps with this perturbation. So basically, in this case, lambda becomes also a function of magnetic field due to this traceless spin orbit term. So in particular for Rushbaugh to Degg, again, you can go through the motions since it's quite Well, okay, you can do it. And there, I'll just show one result. So if you are in the regime of weak magnetic fields, then the first term is very familiar. It's just beatings in Shubnikov degas because you have two orbits of different cross section. Now this term is pretty hard to derive other than this machinery, and it comes from the hybridization of spin bands due to the tilting of the spin out of the plane. It's due to the Zeeman effect. Now I should Adi mentioned that I'll talk about surveillance things. And here they are. So if I apply a magnetic field in plane, as was explained by Adi, you start shifting two circles with respect to each other, but actually they don't really, they don't touch each other, they rather cross. And there is one point where they form a threefold trajectory. So one can ask a question, you know, what happens to quantization, lambda quantization, when you go through this point, okay? So if you have two circles, there, as I said, in weak fields, there are two trajectories and two series of lambda orbits. Now, in this case, it's single trajectory. And basically, if you neglect out of plane Zeeman, there will be ideal Klein tunneling in this point. With Zeeman, there is almost Klein tunneling, so there is some reflection, and you basically have this magnetic breakdown story that I told before. But it raises a general question, can Landau levels cross, okay? And with, here, with this example, we see that actually they do cross because I can, with this term, I can make lambda plus minus lambda minus easily 2 pi n, okay? And every time it's 2 pi n, Landau levels cross because there are two independent orbits. So it turns out that C infinity is not important for that. One can show it for Rajba, for Rajba-Dressinghaus, or for some more complicated anisotropy. So it shows that you can try to make a point group analysis, and that's what Iris did. So putting in general terms, it's the following question. So you have some unitary matrix, which is shown here, and basically these are three. It's one if there is a condition for three real parameters, okay? So under this condition, levels cross. And the question is that this R2, R3, R4 depend on physical parameters such as magnetic field and energy. And the question is whether you can, how many parameters you have to tune to get the zero. It's the same logic as in Wigner-Dyson statistics. But now it's basically based on the symmetry of the crystal, and Iris came up with a full classification of possible of the number of parameters for different symmetries. Basically, it's a question about codimension of the perturbation delta H. And the example that I have shown, Rajba-Dressinghaus, in this case, it's sufficient to tune one parameter to get intersection. For Rajba in tilted field, there are two parameters you have to tune in order to get intersection. So that classification is complete, and there is some huge table that I will not talk about. So in the rest, I think that minus 1 minute or so, I'll tell about application. So one thing that actually, first of all, we're proud to realize that you can get a fake fake news about the topological material, because you see, if you have a condition that sum of lambdas equals pi, and then sum over two different oscillations, cosine plus cosine, you can transform it into cosine times cosine. And if you have sum of the phases pi, then you'll get, you know, some extinguish, some maxima will vanish. And you'll think that you found something, but actually it didn't find anything because it just found that sum is pi rather than each of them is pi or zero. Okay, so it was not, Iris found the paper. Schoenberg, he already understood it some time ago. But what actually is quite, and that's what actually Andrei mentioned to me yesterday. So this wisdom actually got proliferated now. So Phil Moll's group, they looked at this material, which is something complicated for me, tetragonal multiband metal. And basically, this analysis of higher harmonics allowed them to convincingly show that lambda over pi for some small pocket is indeed Berry's 1 minus 0.04 coming from Zeeman effect. So that I would say that, you know, kind of indication of all the effort that we had. Now, one can also show that, you know, if you find pi for some direction, it doesn't mean much, because if you rotate field away from a symmetric axis, this pi may become anything. And here's an example of bismuth tellurite, of tungsten tellurite. Now, in 2D, as I said, because of Landau level, the Fermi level jumps from level to level, the only thing that you can do from find from this kind of theory, and actually it was understood by Beshkova and Rasba, is that you can look at the activation energies between the in the quantum Hall, so to speak, state. And if Landau levels are close to each other, then activation energy becomes small. And this specification of the Landau levels intersections allow us to predict actually make some statements about the activation energies. I will not dwell on that. So basically, I wanted to finish just summarizing that the Fermi surface in momentum space is probed by metric oscillations, and at the level of the WKB, this is the first term here. Okay, but there is another term which comes from the topology of the block wave functions, and that's something new that basically Aris found. And studying the Unzeiger phase shift may actually allow one to find which materials actually are non-trivial. So this is a stop. Thank you.
I have a question. So the phase factor you are discussing is the same as was discussed for metals, so the Berry phase contribution to the Daas van Alphen oscillations. As soon as you have in your orbit some diabolic point, is this the same?
Okay, it's a part of it, but it's not not all. Yes, assume. Yeah. And what again? I'm novice to this field, but what I understood is that basically. The phase doesn't have to be quantized, okay? So if you're very close to direct point, indeed you find this pi, but it will go higher energies. There are some other terms that contribute to the phase. It doesn't have to be pi.
Oh, okay.
Because, I mean, there is one relatively trivial thing, transitions to higher bands, which give you orbital magnetization. Mm-hmm. Okay, and it's you see, for conventional metals, most of the conventional metals are hexagonal densely packed, I think. So they have inversion symmetry. So for inversion symmetry, you can show that there is no orbital moment. But for complicated materials, there is.
Yeah, but even if you don't have inversion symmetry, well, yeah. If you have inversion symmetry, you would have this Berry phase contribution to
yes.
The Daas van Alphen.
Yes.
But not the extra contribution.
Not the extra, yes, yeah, okay. Right, yeah.
So you mentioned the Berry phase part of the Hamiltonian. I'm more used to the Berry phase showing up in Lagrangians and not contributing to Hamiltonians. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Pardon? Yeah, okay. So thanks. I would say that what I mean by that there in the evolution operator, there is a term that is proportional to the Berry phase.
So it's the action rather than the Hamiltonian or something?
Right, so yes, so the H1, the correction to the Hamiltonian, is a form that is valid on the classical orbit. It's not, you know, it's not a Hamiltonian that you can use for anything. So basically it's a phase, it's an action, yes.
I wonder, you talk about this degeneracy, remember, and I wonder, is it this degeneracy is kind of based on certain, how exact it is? So can you leave this degeneracy by something or in some exact statement?
Yeah, thanks. So it gives me an opportunity to repeat one part which I completely scrambled, I guess. So indeed, so let's start with in the degenerate case. What I'm saying is that there is a leading term in magnetic field and then subleading term that gives you this Anzeiger phase shift. Okay, so there is already a perturbation theory in the field. On top of that, if there is no exact degeneracy, I may view my real system as a perturbation away from exact degeneracy, and this away is in this delta epsilon. And then you just do the same thing. Okay, and basically that's another. So here is an example where the away from degeneracy sits here, and the Berry connection sits here basically, and they are on equal footing and under some square root. So that's an example. Yep.
Oh, so a small question. So you showed us slides about strained tungsten ditelluride. Strained tungsten ditelluride, WTE2.
Yeah.
So can you say it again? Why do you need it to be strained?
Just a second. Let's see. I maybe have a slide. Some more details later. So without strained, is this lambda sub just?
There was one slide that you showed. It's close to the end of your talk. There is one slide that where you showed strained.
Oh, okay.
Right, this one, yes. I'm just wondering why you need it to be strained.
Right. So as far as there was, without a strain, you're getting lambda equals pi for all the directions.
Is it because the symmetry changed? Or
yes. Yeah. Yes. So basically, for strain along, that doesn't destroy the rotation axis, but it changes the symmetry with respect to rotating away from the symmetry axis.
In a twisted bilayer graphene,
uh-huh.
you expect to have Fermi surface topology changes together with Van Hoff singularities happening at the same time. Will this show a signature in the Das Van Alphen, or better, Shubnikov Das?
There's one shameful part of an answer, another one is less shameful. So the shameful is that I didn't think about it. I'm not sure what to answer. Now I can tell you why I didn't think about this much. So in 2D, well, probably you know it better. So in 2D, the problem is that basically at low temperatures, the chemical potential jumps from one level to another. So because you do have oscillations, but these oscillations actually come at half filling of Landau level, no matter what, and they are not sensitive to the Anzeiger phase factor.
Even if the temperature is higher than the.
Yeah, I think that even if temperature is okay, so I'm not sure that everybody agree, and there is some relatively obscure paper of Miniev and Thierry Champel that claim otherwise, but to the best of my knowledge, even at high temperatures, if you just go through the motions, it still looks like the maxima correspond to half-filled Landau levels rather than this stuff. Yeah, yeah. So that's why I didn't, you know, I that's why I don't have answer to your first part, but I should.
Could you speak up, Andre?
So normally for bands, I have some Berry phase that I can classify them as filled bands.
For filled bands, yes. Yeah.
Supposedly they classify them uniquely for.
Yes.
And then for Fermi surfaces, the only extra thing that I have is somehow density of states. Right. So is this? Do you understand physically this vector some convolution between the Berry phases at some energy and density of states, or? how should I think of it? All these extra phases.
Okay.
If you have a partial.
I hear what you're saying. Yeah, I think that.
Or if I go to a flat band in another case, so if I take my bandwidth and go to zero, what would this?
Right. Yeah, this is a great question. In my primitive understanding now is that basically this is kind of way more detailed information because it gives you bare face for a given trajectory, right? So now, if you somehow integrate all the trajectories over the entire band, you'll get the topological invariant. It's great. Physically, whether there is a way indeed to do this integration, I'm not sure because once again, you cannot change the. Basically, the Fermi surface. So you can change direction of the magnetic field and strength of the magnetic field, but you probe only one energy. So if there is a way to change,
in 3D, I have, right, let's say, a 2D Fermi surface, I have some Berry phase around, like you were showing.
Yes, yeah.
With pinching points, et cetera. So somehow.
Right, but you cannot integrate over different energies, right? So that's the same. Unless you can change density. So in principle, if you, 2D is not good, but in 2D you can change density. So then I would envision that, if you can measure the phase shift for the densities and scan all the densities from bend, from edge to edge, from bandage to bandage, then there should be indeed integral of this, some of these phases should probably somehow add to the C,
right,
of the band. Yeah.
Okay, let's thank Leonid for a great talk. Yeah.